hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Industrial Education and Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee. Ms. Schaefer, will you take the roll?
Pawlowski.
Present.
Pawlowski, present. Sandel.
Present.
Sandel, present. Keel.
Present.
Keel, present. Bierman.
Present.
Bierman, present. Bliss.
Present.
Bliss, present. Burkle.
Present.
Burkle, present. Edelson.
Present.
Edelson, present.
Present.
Frazier, present. Hamilton.
Present.
Hamilton, present. Liz Lagarde.
Present.
Liz Lagarde, present. McDonald.
Present.
McDonald, present. Sandstead.
Present.
Sandstead, present. Sundin.
Present.
Sundin, present. Mr. Chair, a quorum is present.
Representative Sandel, do you have a motion for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have read the minutes of our previous meeting, and I move their adoption.
Representative Sandel moves the minutes of the previous meeting. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The first item on the agenda is House File 1337. Representative Liz Lagarde, you are on the committee, so do you have a motion for us regarding your bill?
I do. Mr. Chair, I move that House File 1337 to be before the committee with a motion to refer it to the House Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee.
And to put the bill in order, you have an amendment to your bill. Why don't you move your amendment and we'll adopt it, or move your amendment, explain it, then we'll adopt it, and we'll put the bill in the proper order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to amend the bill. The amendment simplifies the bill to the Department of Labor expenditure to the Minnesota Virtual Academy to support working with schools to increase enrollment in these pathways. It'll also require a report back to the legislators so we can evaluate the success of the program. That is what the amendment is.
And members, this is a DE amendment, and we usually have the courtesy of putting the bill in the order the author wants, and then we will discuss it and debate it and take action on it. So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment by Representative Liz Lagarde signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. The bill is in the order that you wish. Representative Liz Lagarde, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 1337, as amended, touches on an issue that this committee discussed a couple weeks ago. The operating engineer 49ers entered into a partnership with the Minnesota Virtual Academy to develop a pathway program for high school students who are interested in exploring a career in heavy equipment operation. This K-12 industry partnership has already shown incredible success in reaching students across this state, as we heard a couple weeks ago. This bill is a straightforward. It would make a $100,000 appropriation through the Department of Labor and Industry for Minnesota Virtual Academy to work with school districts to connect more students to this pathway. This would be a pilot program, and they would report back to us so we could assess the effectiveness of this program. I do have with me today two testifiers who will give more details on the partnership and the pathway of this program and answer any questions this committee may have, Mr. Chair.
All right, the first person on my list is Leslie Lewandowski. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Leslie Lewandowski, and I am the Career Readiness Program Coordinator for Minnesota Virtual Academy. And I thank you again for having us back this morning. We did testify a couple weeks ago, and so we're not going to rehash and go back over that. But I do have a couple slides. I know you have information in your packet, as we would like to talk a little bit more in depth about the pathway and the programs. So I will pull up my screen here a minute for you. as Representative Lislegard stated, the operating engineers, Local 49 and Minnesota Virtual Academy have partnered together for the Operating Engineers Apprenticeship Readiness Pathway. This is part of the program at Minnesota Virtual Academy and is open to all students across the state of Minnesota. What we wanted to touch on today with you is kind of the course offerings and what that looks like for students and what they get from the program by being a part of that. So as we've stated, there are four courses that are offered through this pathway. It starts with a Constructions Explorations course, which that in itself, titles sometimes can be a little bit confusing because we often connect construction with building. But instead, this Explorations course really focuses in on basic equipment and all of the roles within the operating engineers and heavy equipment field. It prepares students with a general overview of that. We then move into a basic grade and construction math course, which then starts to touch in more specifically on, again, basic grade, tying it into hands-on applications for math. This course is a course that we're currently aligning as well, so that it could be counted towards a Minnesota Math Standards course. So students maybe that are struggling more in their traditional math courses would be able to use this and take this course to help them supplant another course within the path in their math sequence in high school. And then the last two courses that we have go into a basic construction, equipment fundamentals, and then basic maintenance of mobile equipment. Those courses, again, just go deeper into the pathway. And the intent of all four of these courses is to bring students the information that they would need to be better informed about the pathway and in making their choice if this is something they wish to continue to pursue post-graduation. I think it is important to highlight that with our courses, they are virtual courses with intentional hands-on support. So our coursework, while it's developed and delivered through the Minnesota Virtual Learning Platform, that allows any student, no matter where they are in the state, to access it through the D2L platform. It also gives the opportunity for students, depending on where they're coming from, what other school districts they might be attending, to access those live teaching sessions, potentially while they're happening, or we record them so that they can take it and access the same information outside of their traditional school hours, or let's say they have a study hall scheduled during their day, they can access it when they want. And that was a huge part of why Local 49 and Minnesota Virtual Academy partnered together for this, was so that there were no barriers to students as to how and when they could access it. The next thing I want to highlight for you is the fact that there are hands-on activities. So yes, we're offering it through a virtual course platform, but our partnership with Local 49 allows us the benefit of being able to bring hands-on activities to our students across the state. As the courses sequence, the level of hands-on opportunities increases. And so while in our initial explorations course, maybe we are just doing a basic virtual field trip of the training center at the Local 49 in Hinckley, what we will do by the end of the pathway is students will actually be able to travel and participate in hands-on opportunities directly at the training facility. We will also throughout the courses have opportunities to set up stations across the state where we bring in simulators. So schools will be able to come in different regions to be able to access those simulators and get those experiences as well. So it's a well-rounded opportunity for our students in order to be able to both virtually have it, but also get those really critical hands-on opportunities that they need to really be able to understand what this pathway is all about. I do want to share with you, because we did touch on this initially, our first semester, again, we had 51 students. So if you look at this slide, you can see first semester where our footprint was in the state of Minnesota. Again, we had, you know, just an explosion in enrollment for our second semester. And you can see visually by looking at these two heat maps side by side how we've already increased our enrollment and interest in that pathway. We are excited to say we have regular phone calls happening weekly for students that are interested in registering again for next fall. And so we know that our enrollment is going to continue to expand and our footprint across the state is going to continue to get larger as we look at that. We currently are representing 39 counties and 66 school districts in our second semester. At this time, Chair, I would like to turn over the next part of the presentation to Jenny Winkler.
All right, Ms. Winkler, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jenny Winkler. I am the Director of Workforce and Community Development for Operating Engineers Local 49. Thank you for your time today. I just wanted to touch on a few of the benefits for students who enroll in this pathway program and why Local 49 is a proud partner in this endeavor. I like to think of it as a 3-for-1 opportunity for students. Not only did they receive high school elective credit, they also received for 3 of the 4 courses articulated college credit, as well as credit toward our apprenticeship program should they reach the ultimate goal, and we hope that they do, transition into our registered apprenticeship program. We also have a very intentional engagement with our partners in the industry for students. We have panels that engage with the students and talk about industry opportunities, spring hiring needs, what students would need to do should they decide to pursue a career in the operating engineers. This work is important for Local 49 as we think about our equity goals, not only in terms of outreach and recruitment, but also in terms of placement and retention. Being an operating engineer requires a high level of skill, and sometimes that requires some additional preparation. We feel it's critical to get students clearer information at an earlier age, but particularly students who may not have any connection currently in the industry. This allows students to make informed choices about coursework and decisions within their lives, such as obtaining a driver's license that ultimately will put them on the best course for success. We are really proud to say that 15% of our initial cohort were females, and 7% of our current students enrolled in the program are students of color. We hope to see that these numbers will continue to increase as the program continues to grow. At this point, I'd like to turn testimony back over to my colleague, Leslie, just to share some of the challenges that we've had in promoting this program that this bill seeks to address.
Ms. Lewandowski.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we just wanted to touch on again some of those challenges that we have seen over the course of this last school year. You know, the biggest one that we have run up to as we continue to meet with school districts across the state of Minnesota is that financial impact of the pathway enrollment. We are not working towards students coming into MNVA as full-time students. What we really are trying to do is support school districts across the state in having those students participate as a shared time enrolled student. So they are taking 1 or 2 of the pathway courses while remaining in their school district to keep those courses that they would traditionally do at their traditional high school. What we found through this is as we talk to school districts and talk about those challenges is that if we could find a way to offset the budgetary impact for students, that it becomes a different conversation. Instead of school districts saying to us, yes, this is a great opportunity, but sorry, we're not gonna support promoting this because we just financially can't handle it, or setting up systems that actually deter students from participating by, you know, having students informed that they won't be able to participate in graduation if they're not enrolled full-time in their school district. We know that if we can offset that budgetary impact, school districts then are very open and eager to have the conversation and promote the pathway to students that are there. So we know specifically that dollars allocated through House File 1337 will allow schools to support the participation of students in this pathway, which is in the best interest of those students, rather than school districts choosing between that and their bottom line. So we are very, very interested and excited to see this as a possibility because we know that this impact on students across the state will be highly influenced by that. And that is all we had for our presentation to you today. In your packet, you do have links again to the overview video that we have, as well as links to Local 49 and to the STRIDE Career Prep Program at MNVA. And our contact information is there as well. So outside of this testimony, if there are other questions that come up, please feel free to contact either Jenny or myself at any time. And we are more than happy to have a conversation with you and answer any questions you have at this time.
Right. Ms. Lewandowski, I've got a question, and we're trying to get answers to this question. And if you can't answer it, that's fine. But do you know of the federal stimulus money that was passed last December and the potential of even more federal stimulus money coming? And there is a large amount coming to the school districts. Can the school districts access that money and apply it to this program?
I have to say, Chair, that I am not sure exactly of that. I'm more than happy to do some research on that and find an answer for you. But at this time, I don't have a direct answer on that. I know money is coming, but again, I'm not aware of what the guidelines around that are for expenditure.
We had staff that was here at the beginning, and I'm looking to see if staff is still here at this junction. Mr. Strom, do you know anything about the federal stimulus money and how that's being dispersed at the school district level?
Mr. Chair, members, there's currently three different primary pots of federal stimulus money from the two bills that have passed. The bill that's likely to pass in the next week or so, I am unfamiliar with the restrictions. The full list of restrictions there. Some of the money may be able to be applied to a program like this. In the past sets of money, one of the issues tends to be that the distribution of the federal funds is on the primary distribution mechanism is on the federal Title I-A distribution, which can be somewhat uneven across school districts. It reflects the way that Title I money is distributed to them. But I'll do some checking as well and see if a support of a program like this would fall under the uses for the federal money.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Members, I bring it up not to deter us from doing this, but to encourage us to do this, because I think there are a number of opportunities here that would enhance this program if the districts can use some of that federal stimulus money to even add more, because obviously this program is expanding and the need is out there. So with that, I don't see any hands up. Or should I see it? All right, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to Representative Listelgard for bringing the bill forward. I like this bill a lot. I do have a couple questions for Ms. Lewandowski. And in regards to the program, is there a capacity number of students that you can have participate in an online program such as this?
Ms. Lewandowski.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yes, so Minnesota statute is clear around classroom capacity for a course. It runs around 40 students per course. Within that, though, we have the ability to hire instructors. So if we have more capacity than, what one instructor can have, we can bring in another instructor or increase that instructor's FTE to make sure that they could teach two courses with it. So we are actively working. We currently have two instructors in this pathway that are teaching for us. And then we are, actively recruiting and identifying other instructors that can come in, because the trajectory that we are currently on will have this be a full-time FTE for someone within a very short period. And so we know that we have the need to add capacity within the teaching staff to be able to do that. We currently, because of our teaching load that we have, we did have to cap student enrollment for this past semester because we were slightly over that target mark. It wasn't enough to be able to justify adding an additional instructor. But with the rapid growth, we've taken away some great lessons and feel like we're better prepared for next fall to make sure that any student that wants to come in will be able to come in and wouldn't be turned away due to capacity size.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up then. So I think in the bill it's $100,000. And so I know with what you just said, it's hard to determine how long that would last. But could you tell us how long that will last?
Ms. Lewandowski.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. We actually have calculated it out, and depending on how the money is distributed between the students, we have the ability, if we have, you know, one student taking two or more courses, it could range between 40 and 80 students that would be benefited by the $100,000 that we have. So it is just touching on it, yes, when you calculate it out. Most students will take one course per semester, but we do have some students that are seniors that have space and capacity in their schedules to take more than one. So there could be requests from school districts for, you know, more than just one course per student per semester with these dollars.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may ask a question of Ms. Winkler as well, in regards to the apprenticeship program at Local 49. Some apprenticeship programs, I understand, they want students to come out of high school and have some experience before they join an apprenticeship. And I'm not sure if what Local 49's normal routing is for students. But can you tell me if a student takes some of these programs in high school on this online, would they come right out of high school and go to the apprenticeship program at Local 49?
Ms. Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman, Local 49 would, in fact, hopefully shepherd the students right into registered apprenticeship with Local 49 if that's something the student ultimately likes to achieve. Matter of fact, the students would also receive credit toward their related training in our apprenticeship program. 7.5 hours per semester module for a total of 30 hours. If that student, in addition to that, chooses to go online and complete the OSHA 10, they would come in with 40 hours of credit toward our apprenticeship program, toward their related training.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just one follow-up. That's what I expected would be the case. How many apprenticeships are there on site for students per year?
Ms. Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman, the way apprentices get into Local 49 is they actually are sponsored in by an employer, which is why we're having the students have those interactive panels with our contractors. So really, it just depends each year what the work scope looks like and workload looks like for the industry. In the past 2 years, we've brought on over 100 apprentices each year, respectively.
Representative Bierman.
That's a big number. That's excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if when we talk about this is an excellent program, I'm just thrilled to hear that we're looking at doing this. But as Chair Pawlowski pointed out, funding is a problem. And I've heard from more than one school that children, sometimes students cannot get into a program just because of the fear of, you know, one of the other schools worrying about the financing of what they're losing or how they cover it. But I'm wondering, is there any way, do we know, Chair Pawlowski, if there's a federal career in tech funding at all, you know, that used to really fund our schools, and now that has been cut back quite a bit.
Representative Keel, the reason why I raised my question earlier was because of the large amount of federal stimulus money that has already been sent to the state, and then the second wave of federal stimulus money that we're expecting, and how that can be used. There is, as you've just seen from Mr. Strom, we don't have the ability yet to articulate that. And I'm hoping that the Education Committee, both higher ed and K-12, we'll dive into this somewhat deeply and find out where this money is and where it's going. It is an incredible amount of money, and it's an opportunity we simply can't waste. So I've raised the issue. We can come back to you. If Mr. Strom is still there, he may have an answer to your question if there's federal money that was currently available before and that we haven't accessed or we could access. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, perhaps Ms. Lewandowski, who's quite familiar with their program, could talk about the ways that the Perkins money, the federal career and tech money, can be interwoven. Minnesota has a different path than some states on its federal Perkins money, which is the career and tech money from the federal government. So it tends to less provide outright assistance for the programs than sort of underline the structure that allows career and tech programming. But perhaps in the case of the Virtual Academy in the Houston School District, Ms. Lewandowski could talk a little about its role there.
Thank you, Ms. Lewandowski.
Thank you, Chair. And yes, as Mr. Strom pointed out, career and technical education funding is something that is allocated in a certain way in the state of Minnesota. So those Perkins funds come into the various consortia across the state of Minnesota. Because we are in Houston County as part of the Houston Public School District, we are part of the Southeastern Minnesota consortia. So our students, as this is, becomes an approved CTE pathway, would be able to be reported through that consortia for Perkins funding. One of the issues with Perkins funding is, again, it doesn't typically pay to offset costs like this. What it does is buys and purchases supplies. It offsets costs to the program. School districts typically, you know, go to their consortia with a grant request for maybe $1,500, $5,000 would be a high amount of money for them to be asking for, and it would be to buy equipment or other supplies in order for them to support a pathway. So the way that it is set up, you know, we often talk about Perkins money as being a lot of work, sometimes for not a lot of return on the money that comes into the school for it. So it's a viable, you know, pool for us to look at for supplanting costs, but it isn't something that would make a huge financial dent into what we are looking to do through the work in this pathway.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Lewandowski, for that response. I had forgotten a long time ago, I was on the Career and Tech Parent Group when Mr. Tolbert in the Crookston, the Northwest Consortium, and I remember him talking about how difficult it was to get the funding in, and he's known as the king of funding because he really could supply a lot of money. He has since retired quite a while ago. So, but that is, yeah. I really sometimes wonder if this is going to be off the wall, Chair Pulowski, but I sometimes wonder if our special ed dollars shouldn't be going to more career classes, because I think so many of these kids have a point they can shine in that is not readily available in regular academic classes. And I just think it's really important we search. So whatever we can do to move this forward, whether it's to contact our congressmen to let them know, our senators to let them know this is important as that direction. And then of course our own education department to make sure they understand the importance. I've actually had some reticence, Chair Pulowski, with earlier, it's been a different department now, education department leadership, but they had a hard time with career and tech. They felt we were taking something away for students when in fact, I think we're just enhancing education and helping them to figure out what they need and where they need to go. So thank you.
All right, Representative Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Liz Lagarde, for bringing this bill, and thank you, Local 49, for partnering here. My question is for Ms. Lewandowski. How you doing, Ms. Lewandowski?
I am very good. Thank you, Representative Frazier.
Good to see you. We have a history, and that Perkins conversation made me think about something we worked on a few years ago that was quite involved for not very much outcome. So thank you for making me have that flashback.
You're welcome.
Hey, my question is, you had the slide about the equity pieces in there, and I had to turn away for a second, so I apologize, but can you talk a little bit more about that, just about the outreach pieces and the equity impact you've had so far with this program?
Ms. Lewandowski.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for that question, because we talk about equity, and in education, we use the term equity in a variety of spaces. So we talk about equal access to all, but we also then look very deeply at equity as how are we promoting to our students of color, underrepresented populations, those that are underrepresented in fields. And so when we look at Local 49, you know, from an education stance, I approached those equity questions with Local 49, specifically around students of color, as well as females. And so we were super excited. In our, you know, we launched this spring. We started conversations last May, started meeting with school districts across the summer, just trying to share information in general without a specific equity strategy in place at that time. But what we saw come to light very quickly was 15% of that first cohort were female students, which is very unusual in this field. On public work jobs, it's been brought to my attention, you know, the goal is to have 20% female. And so to be at a space where we had 15% without actively pursuing that was huge. We also, in pulling our numbers, are currently at 7% students of color, which, again, this is not always a field that, you know, family history has not had students of color, you know, a long history of students working in the field. And so we're very happy with that. What we've done is one of our instructors that we just brought on is a female instructor. That was something for us was a great way for more female students to see themselves, not only as a teacher, but also as somebody in this industry. And working in that field. Our instructor who's teaching for us has a connection to the field through a husband, you know, so it's kind of a side connection to it, but really does understand what that field looks like. So as we continue to do that, we are supporting our students that are coming to us, both our female and students of color, by making sure that we're connecting the dots, making sure we're very aware of, you know, maybe past practices that didn't support that. One of the best things that I can say, and I have put Ms. Winkler to task on this one, but this program has been highlighted already as being something within the field as a program and a pathway that is supporting equity change. And so we talk about that regularly. We have conversations around it very, you know, specifically, because we do not want to bring students into a pathway that once they are full-time enrolled and employed in that pathway, that they bump up into issues and situations that are not beneficial for them.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewandowski, thank you for sharing that information.
You're welcome.
Members, I don't have any other questions. And seeing there are no other questions, I'll return to Representative Lissegaard to sum up and perhaps renew his motion. Representative Lissegaard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What a wonderful conversation that I witnessed here today. And I wrote down words like equity and opportunity. Representative Keel, that really struck my heart right there when you talked about special ed and those kids that sometimes we feel like they're going to be left behind because they don't, from an academic standpoint, they just don't seem like they meet the mark. And opportunities like this, I think, are extremely important. And when you mentioned equity regarding females, my daughter, which this is her, she is a licensed operator. She is a 49er. She didn't go through this program. She did take one semester at a community college. Some of those credits transferred, but others didn't. And then she went on to Staples and got it and then finished up through the apprenticeship. Just because you go to a two-year technical school does not mean you are a full-time operator. The 49ers are very, very strategic in making sure that all of their operators are properly trained to be able to meet the needs of the project in front of them. So for individuals to get an opportunity to see it, feel it, and touch it at a young age through this program, I'm extremely excited to be able to carry this bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would hope that you guys would support the motion to refer House File 1337 as amended to House Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you.
All right, the clerk will take the roll.
Pulowski.
Pulowski votes aye.
Pulowski aye. Sandel.
Aye.
Sandel aye. Keel?
Aye.
Keel, aye. Bierman?
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Bliss?
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Burkle?
Aye.
Edelson?
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Frazier?
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Hamilton?
Aye.
Hamilton, aye. Liz Lagarde?
Aye.
Liz Lagarde, aye. McDonald?
McDonald, aye.
McDonald, aye. Sandsted?
Aye.
Sandsted, aye. Sundin?
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. 13 ayes, 0 nays.
13 ayes, 0 nays. The motion prevails and the bill is passed. Members, the next item on the agenda is a presentation by Representative Sandell, and I believe he has an item in his packet that he's going to present, and then he also has a presenter to assist him. So, Representative Sandell, turn it over to you.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski and members. Thanks very much for taking time this morning to hear our proposal to strengthen and extend the work of school-based health clinics throughout Minnesota. It's an enormously important idea. The bill is provided in the information that Mr. Wirth has distributed, and it will have its first hearing in the House tomorrow. It seems to me there's no more compelling challenge in this legislature than to protect and nurture the health and well-being of our children, all of our children. The strength of this economy, our civic life, our personal lives, all depend on an attentive, accessible, and affordable healthcare presence. School-based health clinics are a common sense, affordable, and powerful response. Our proposal asks for grants of $250,000 in each year of the biennium, investing in a public-private partnership imagined and initiated by the Minnesota School-Based Health Alliance, part of a national organization of school-based health services. The model links school districts, private health plans, hospitals, physicians, and other healthcare professionals to serve and coordinate payment and care, all of which could be available for kids and their families through these healthcare, the school-based health clinics. Getting services to students is the objective of this project. We're not starting from scratch. My colleague, Shauna Hedlund, will tell you in a couple of minutes how and where school-based clinics are already operating in Minnesota and how operations like hers work with the National Alliance of School-Based Health Clinics. I taught school, as many of you have. I was in this classroom for more than 25 years in both very poor and very affluent communities. The work we do in schools, of course, is essential. But the most consistent indicator of success in school and lifetime independence is the care of a young person's health from pre and postnatal months through their high school years. Experience and research supports that. Some of you will recognize school-based clinics as a feature of a community schools model, and that's right. From our point of view, the clinic is the foundation of those wraparound services, but those services are not available yet in very many places. This proposal offers a jumpstart moving forward at an expedited and responsible pace to establish those services where they're not yet available, to focus our efforts where they'll do the most good throughout the state and get services to children and families that need them through an alliance of providers. Terrifically important. I'm a real fundamentalist when it comes to our society's well-being, and I'm convinced by my experience and research that the health of our children, all of our children, is fundamental to our social contract. A commitment to education and to the future of economic opportunity. And that's why I'm encouraging you to support this proposal as it moves forward. I'd like you to hear more from Shauna Hedlund, a colleague and a real leader in the community health movement throughout Minnesota. Ms. Hedlund is here, and she'll tell you a little bit more about how these programs work and how we expect to go forward. Ms. Hedlund?
Shauna Hedlund, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski and Representative Sandell. My name is Shauna Hedlund, and I am the Director of Public Health and Policy for Minnesota Community Care and I'm the President of the Minnesota School-Based Health Alliance. And I appreciate that introduction and your very clear understanding of the purpose of school-based health centers and the advantages of them for schools. I think I'm going to start by identifying why school-based health centers are a successful model. And also, school-based health centers, for those that are not aware, actually got a start here in Minnesota. St. Paul's public school-based health centers were some of the first in the nation, developed with the intention of providing healthcare that supports learning and keeps kids in school. We now have 24 in Minnesota, and very few in rural Minnesota. We have a legacy that we feel we have an opportunity to uplift and expand. School-based health centers expand upon allied roles of school nursing and social work, but they do not supplant them. They provide medical care and therapy in school where kids spend their days. Health equity and education equity go hand in hand. School-based health clinics are a model through which we join efforts and outcomes in addressing disparities in both of these areas. For instance, we know that two of the most significant detractors from young children's success in school is tooth pain and vision problems. And these are two areas that we can very easily address on campus without kids even leaving school in a school-based clinic model. School-based clinics are a learning environment for student patients as well. They are learning about self-care, about healthcare access. They learn about insurance. They learn about benefits and programs available to them and their families, and they learn about healthcare careers. For instance, at one point in time, 91% of our medical assistants working inside of the school-based clinics were actually previous patients in our program. We have former students, student patients applying for nurse practitioner and therapist positions quite often. And we even know a former patient who is on the school board in St. Paul, and both she and her children were patients at the school-based health centers. Some school-based clinics are inside of full-service community schools, as Representative Sandell explained, but this is limited funding, and Minnesota School-Based Health Alliance can assist with the development of integrated full-service health centers inside of schools that do not have access to this funding. We are a partner of full service community schools and expansion upon that work. We want to ensure that school-based clinics are a continuous care model for children and youth as their insurance access changes, which we have seen quite a bit of this in this last year, managing COVID and quite a bit of job loss. And in order to uphold this, we suggest codifying in law that school-based health centers will turn no child away for their ability to pay. And that is an agreement with the health care provider associated with the school district. We have strong engaged healthcare providers leading the way in this model, including Mayo Clinic, St. Kate's, Mankato State, Park Nicollet, Local Health Public Health, City of Minneapolis, and the federal safety net model, community health centers, like my place of work, Minnesota Community Care. This assures some unified practices and core competencies shared among those healthcare organizations, but we also see we have many business models that can work to support school-based clinics. We see this opportunity today and this bill as an enhancement of our COVID recovery in schools. We anticipate students returning to learn, and we will be identifying as they return their unmet healthcare needs with a year of limited access to school nurses and pediatric care. Schools have reported to us that they are quite overwhelmed by this, and we have opportunity to assist. So why? That's a little bit about why school-based health centers, and I'd like to now talk a little bit about why a school-based health alliance could be helpful. 38 states have a school-based health alliance, but each one is different, and Minnesota is based upon a successful blueprint, but will continue to be customized in Minnesota. As Representative Sandell stated, we are an affiliate of a national organization, which convenes state leaders to share best practices, advocates for federal funding, guides quality initiatives, and assists with advancements such as telehealth expansion. Our current board members are leaders from each of the organizations that support school-based health centers, as I listed earlier. And our fiscal agent is Minnesota Community Care, as the largest FQHC in Minnesota with a 50-year tradition of operating school-based clinics. Many current school-based health centers have youth advisory boards, which are also youth development and career exploration models, and particularly in areas where we have shortages, particularly providers of color. School-based Health Alliance will convene as well a statewide youth advisory board. One of the major functions of the School-Based Health Alliance will be to assist with sustainability of school-based health centers. School-Based Health Alliance provides technical assistance with grant opportunities, whether federal, foundational, or state, as well as billing Medicaid for eligible visits, which is key to sustainability. We also will ensure that school-based health centers are authorized and eligible to receive government funding by adhering to the core competencies. For instance, we saw in the December COVID response bill a reauthorization of federal funding, potential federal funding for school-based health centers that adhere to core competencies. A School-Based Health Alliance is a cooperative agency to convene intergovernmental partners. I know we have MDH and MDE listening in today. Those other partners include DHS, school districts, and other stakeholders. And we see a significant opportunity in rural Minnesota to expand this model of care and educational support. But we need to support, we need support and technical assistance for districts and healthcare providers need guidance in establishing these relationships. And the demand for technical assistance from school districts right now and healthcare providers in seeking to collaborate in school-based clinics is beginning to overwhelm our currently volunteer-driven School-Based Health Alliance. Lastly, evidence suggests that states that have succeeded with critical statewide expansion of this healthcare and education equity solution have four things that Minnesota currently does not. One, state funding to sustain a School-Based Health Alliance. Two, definition of school-based health centers in statute that suggests partners in healthcare turn no child away for their ability to pay. Three, state funding streams to develop new school-based health centers. And four, state funding to sustain school-based health centers. Our ask this year is to start with just number one and two, support for the School-Based Health Alliance, so we can begin to dive into this further, and a definition of school-based health centers. I wanted just to end by saying we hope that what you hear is that school-based health clinics help bypass larger social structure and conditions that present barriers to care and therefore educational present barriers or opportunities in educational success. School-based health centers also allow students and entire families to become easily engaged, knowledgeable about health, healthcare, and in so doing, we're improving economic conditions for kids' futures and for entire communities. And I'm happy to take your questions.
Senator Sandell, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members and Ms. Hedlund. School-based health clinics are the reason I ran for the legislature 2 years ago. As I mentioned in my early remarks, my experience has been with kids who have wanted and have found unavailable health care from early prenatal and postnatal care, protection from abuse and neglect, poor nutrition, lack of a loving adult at home. By the time those children are in third grade, they become marginalized. By the time they're in fifth grade, there are problems. By the time they're in junior high, their future in schools and as independent citizens is questionable. There are some families among us, mine, for example, who might use a service like this infrequently. I'm protected with a health care plan. My children were lucky to have attentive care as they grew up. But the research shows, not just anecdotally, but the serious academic and professional research shows that attention to a young child's and a young family's well-being is the single most predictable part of our of growing up, success in school, and success as an independent citizen. Ms. Hedlund and her organizations have been in the leadership of this. School districts, school states around the country have found, as she said, different ways to support this project and program. I hope our bill will give a chance to strengthen the alliance in Minnesota and move forward offering children and their families throughout the state of Minnesota this kind of attentive and affordable and convenient health care. Now, I know that there are some of you representatives in this community from rural Minnesota. I've spent lots of time in the last 55 years in Yellow Medicine County, where my wife's family has had a farm for more than 150 years. And I know that children in those communities have had a hard time finding accessible health care. This project would bring health care clinics as to a convenient, attractive and available circumstance where individuals did not have to worry about paying for these services. The private-public partnership in this is unique and enormously important. So with all of that, I hesitate to speak further, but I'm enormously enthusiastic about the potential of this partnership, and I hope that we can have your support as this bill moves forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your indulgence and patience.
Members, any questions? Representative Beer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Sandell, for the bill and the information today. Could you comment a little bit on the flexibility in the program for local schools and communities to make the decisions on how to utilize the funds and create their own version that fits their community best? I mean, as you described, healthcare needs are so wide, you know, from mental health to physical issues that students have when they come into the building. And you mentioned at the start, the one that I think is so important is nutrition.
Yeah.
You know, when I talk to teachers, you know, they tell me they know which students are hungry when they walk in the building. And so I think that it's really important, as you noted, you know, what's happening in one location is different than another. So if you could just comment on the ability of this bill to give schools flexibility, I would appreciate it.
Sure.
Representative Sandell.
Plosky and Representative Bierman. The website of the national organization identifies the approach to those questions in the different, in the 39 different states that provide this sort of service. One of my graduate school professors, Mike Kirst, has been doing this in California and provides a detailed presentation how individual districts find relationships with their county, state agencies, private health care plans, and clinics to individualize this approach. Ms. Hedlund probably can give you examples of how this is being done in Minnesota.
Ms. Hedlund.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski and Representative Bierman. I'll start by mentioning that Park Nicollet has, clinics inside of a couple of full-service community schools. Full-service community schools, that funding pays for a coordinator. It doesn't actually provide for the care, but that coordinator initiates that or starts with a needs assessment in that community upon bringing that funding to the school district. And that needs assessment will bring in stakeholders that will help identify where there are needs for the community and where there are needs for those students. We have examples in Minnesota from everything, and actually I'll speak to Minnesota Community Care where I direct the school-based health centers. At inception, our school-based health centers 50 years ago provided nutrition services, mental health services, medical care, and health education as a suite of services, four pillars of care. That model then became the model for nationally for school-based health centers as they expanded and grew. And what we've seen in the last a couple decades is expansion into chiropractic, into dental care, into optometry, audiology. And these are partnerships that are based upon individual communities' needs. We've also seen changes in technology. And so some of our especially rural areas may simply have a relationship with a healthcare provider via telehealth, where we engaged the school nurse to set up children or potentially their families in a telecommunication with a healthcare provider that's not actually on campus. So there is a wide range of examples of how healthcare can be provided in schools. And I absolutely agree with you that fundamentally it needs to be a match to that school district's needs and to that community's needs. We also have examples right now of, we have full service healthcare clinics inside of high schools and inside of middle schools that are 1100 square feet. We also have a mobile health unit that is really a medical provider with two wagons that she pulls from school to school to provide immunizations as children are catching up from a year without pediatric care. Wide range.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just one other follow-up for Ms. Hedlund. You mentioned FQHCs being having a big role, but I think I remember there's only like 17 FQHC clinics in Minnesota. So could you just expand for a minute on what you said? I didn't catch it all, but I thought I heard you say that they had one of the biggest roles in the schools in Minnesota. So I just wanted some clarification and maybe a little elaboration.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Chair Plusky and Representative Bierman. That is correct. We have 17 FQHCs in the state of Minnesota. And recall that we only have 24 school-based clinics that we can identify, we have identified in the state of Minnesota right now. 10 of those are operated by Minnesota Community Care, which is the largest FQHC in Minnesota. One has been operated by Southside, and two are operated by North Point. Nationally, the FQHC model for operating a school-based clinic is, there's evidence that suggests because of that supportive federal funding stream, it's one of the most sustainable models of providing school-based care. And so this is an opportunity for expansion. The Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, we've been in conversations with about how we can support other FQHCs to consider adopting this model, and particularly in rural Minnesota.
Representative Bierman.
Very helpful. Thank you, Ms. Hedlund. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sandell, I'll let you sum up.
Thank you, Chair Plowski, and ladies and gentlemen, I am enthusiastic about this. I'm dedicated to the idea of making sure that young men and women, when they enter school in preschool or kindergarten, and when they graduate from high school, they are ready for to participate either in post-secondary education or the workforce, and their health is at the foundation of that. I appreciate your time this morning and attention. Ms. Hedlund and I met a couple of years ago when through a mutual friend when we began talking about this issue, and I couldn't be more enthusiastic about supporting her work and the work we see in the future. Thank you, gentlemen and ladies.
All right, thank you, Ms. Hedlund, Representative Sandell. Seeing no other business before the committee is adjourned. Thank you, members.